This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is Barb. Today I'm reading from the New York Times Style section. It's Wednesday, May 15th. The first article, Seven Unforgettable Dogs at Westminster. The dog show can have only one winner, but each canine in contention for the title stood out in their own right. Only one dog could win Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, and this year the honor went to Sage, a spectacularly coiffed miniature poodle, whose main character energy was hard to ignore. But what of the dogs she defeated? Seven dogs entered the final round, each representing distinct canine groups: herding, working, hound, terrier, toy, sporting, and non-sporting. Don't ask what non-sporting means. Theoretically, the group could just be labeled other. The dogs were big and small, fast and slow, excited and phlegmatic, a dizzying range of canine pulchritude and behavior. Each dog was judged on how well they adhered to the platonic ideal of their breed. But even the losers were winners. Here's a look at what made the seven finalists champions in their own right and impossible to forget. Mercedes, most likely to succeed next year. Let's be honest here. Some of the dogs in the final round looked less like dogs and more like clients of a beauty salon staffed by celebrity stylists who had watched Zoolander one too many times. But Mercedes, the magnificent 4-year-old German Shepherd bitch who took reserve Best in Show, that means second place, was all dog. Sadly, she had no chance to demonstrate her prowess at herding, the group to which she belongs. But she cavorted around the ring as if she owned the place and genuinely seemed to be having fun, which was more than you could say for a lot of the dogs. Mercedes' joy and sense of humor were infectious. We hope she comes back in 2025. Sage, most likely to cancel a date to wash her hair. It takes a lot of work and a lot of product to tame your hair into the sort of gravity-defying, topiary-evoking extravaganza expressed so perfectly by Sage, a miniature poodle who was this year's Westminster champion. Never mind that Sage had to be carried into the ring by her devoted handler for the final round, haughty as an empress, while the other dogs, including Comet with his much shorter legs, entered in the usual prosaic way, by jogging without assistance. Maybe this is why miniature poodles belong in the non-sporting group. Sage's mysterious allure and amusing gait, when she did bestir herself to move, it was in a kind of dainty, reluctant trot, stole the judges' hearts, if not America's. Lewis, super modelly. The hound group had won Best in Show in consecutive years at Westminster, and while Lewis, a 6-year-old Afghan hound, couldn't quite live up to those expectations, he left everyone feeling like they could do more with their look. His long and lustrous black hair was worthy of a shampoo commercial or a 1980s rock band. Monty, most likely to petition for a 4-day work week. In real life, dogs from the working group are meant to do specific human-adjacent jobs, and giant schnauzers are no exception. According to the American Kennel Club, they're regularly used in police, military, and search and rescue work. Monty, a 3-year-old who entered Westminster as the top-ranked show dog in the United States, looks more like a white-collar worker. He bore his loss with the sort of dignity and self-possession you would expect from a giant in his field of schnauzers. Comet, most impractical. The dogs of Westminster are judged on how well they meet the specifications of their breed, not whether they'd be up for a game of fetch. So Comet, a 3-year-old Shih Tzu, can be forgiven for exuding an air of luxury rather than one of utility. He's from just outside Toledo, Ohio, but the toy group champion seems like he'd be at home in one of the extremely tall apartment buildings in Midtown Manhattan. Micah, most sporting? The groups for the most part made sense. Toy dogs are small, working dogs work, herding dogs herd. The sporting group has plenty of dogs that live up to the name. Golden Retrievers and Labradors are wildly popular as active pets. But Micah, a 2-year-old black cocker spaniel, looks more like a puppy wearing his mom's mink coat than a hunting companion. Frankie, most ready to rumble. Even the working dogs tend toward fancy at dog shows, and the terriers, by far the dominant group in Westminster history, have plenty of dogs that are somewhere between delicate and nervous. But Frankie, a 3-year-old colored bull terrier, stood out in her very crowded group by looking like she could easily wrestle toys away from the other dogs at the park. May Canada's cold winters have toughened her up? This article was written by Sarah Lyle and Benjamin Hoffman. The second article, A Shock of Red for a Royal Portrait. A new portrait of King Charles III is bathed in symbolism. The article is written by Vanessa Friedman. Royal portraits, as a rule, tend to be fairly staid, predictable affairs. Full of symbolism, sure, but generally symbolism of the traditional establishment kind. Symbols of state, of office, of pomp, and lineage. Which is why the new official portrait of King Charles III by Jonathan Yeo, the first since the king's coronation, has created such a controversy. A larger-than-life 7.5-foot by 5.5-foot canvas, the portrait shows the king standing in his Welsh Guards uniform, hands on the hilt of his sword, a half-smile on his face, with a butterfly hovering just over his right shoulder. His entire body is bathed in a sea of crimson, so his face appears to be floating. Though the butterfly was apparently the key piece of seminology, meant, Mr. Yeo told the BBC, to represent Charles's metamorphosis from prince to sovereign in his long-standing love of the environment, it was the painting's primary color that almost instantaneously gave new meaning to the idea of seeing red. It was practically begging for interpretation. To me, it gives the message of monarchy is going up in flames or the king is burning in hell, one commentator wrote under the royal family's Instagram post when the portrait was unveiled. It looks like he's bathing in blood, another wrote. Someone else raised the idea of colonial bloodshed. There were comparisons to the devil, and so on. There was even a mention of the Tampax affair, a reference to an infamous comment by Charles, revealed when his phone was hacked during the demise of his marriage to Diana, Princess of Wales. It turns out that red is a trigger color for most everyone, especially given the somewhat meta-endeavor that is royal portraiture, a representation of a representation made for posterity. In his interview with the BBC, Mr. Yeo noted that when the king first saw the painting, he was initially mildly surprised by the strong color, which may be an understatement. Mr. Yeo said his goal was to produce a more modern royal portrait, reflecting Charles's desire to be a more modern monarch, reducing the number of working royals and scaling back the pageantry of the coronation, all things being relative. Still, the choice of shade seems particularly fraught, given the, well, firestorm the king has endured since his ascension to the throne. Consider, for example, the continued falling out with his second son, Prince Harry, and the publication of Harry's memoir with its allegations of royal racism, the related calls for an end to the monarchy, Charles's cancer diagnosis, and the furor over mystery about Catherine, Princess of Wales, whose own cancer diagnosis was revealed only after increasingly unhinged speculation about her disappearance from public life. Queen Camilla, who has been through her own ring of flames, reportedly told the artist, "You've got him." It's hard to imagine Mr. Yeo didn't anticipate some of the reaction to the portrait, especially in the context of his past work, including portraits of Prince Philip, the king's father, and Queen Camilla, which are more traditional depictions. Indeed, the last time a royal portraitist attempted a more abstract, contemporary interpretation of their subject, a 1998 portrait of Queen Elizabeth II by Justin Mortimer, which depicted the queen against a neon yellow background with a splash of yellow bisecting her neck. It produced a similar public outcry. The Daily Mail accused the artist of cutting off the queen's head. The portrait of King Charles will remain on display at the Philip Mould Gallery until mid-June, when it will be moved to Draper's Hall in London. It was commissioned by the Worshipful Company of Drapers, a medieval guild turned philanthropy, to reside among hundreds of other more orthodox royal portraits. In that setting, Mr. Yeo's work may be especially telling, reflective of not just a monarch, but also the evolution of the role itself, the conflicts around the job, and a king captured forevermore in what very much looks like the hot seat. The next article, Wall Street bigwigs raise $68.5 million to fight poverty. There is a photograph showing Paul Tudor Jones II, the billionaire hedge fund manager and a co-founder of Robinhood, dressed as Neo of the Matrix in a long silk coat and with the neon signs in blue and green behind him. This article is written by Katie Van Sickle. The Robin Hood Foundation, an anti-poverty organization in New York City, threw a Matrix-inspired gala. On the second Monday in May, the Empire State Building flickered Robin Hood green for a night when some of New York City's deepest pockets gathered for a charitable cause. A few thousand guests packed into the Javits Center for the annual gala hosted by Robin Hood, an anti-poverty group that gives millions in grants each year to organizations across the city and which has long been a popular charity among Wall Street's heavy hitters. The convention center was transformed into a futurescape, with large inflatable clouds and performers dangling from the rafters on swings. A sign near the entrance invited people to the Robin Hood Matrix, a vision of New York City limited only by your imagination. Pat Kiernan, the NY1 anchor, arrived early in the evening. Like other guests, he walked through a smokes machine and a tunnel lit with green lasers, drawing on the imagery of the iconic 1999 Keanu Reeves sci-fi film. "I really just respect the work that Robin Hood does and the way they do it to get out into the community and really measure the effectiveness of things," said Mr. Kiernan, who added that he had attended the event before. There are photographs of Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan district attorney, embracing another guest. There's a photograph of Governor Kathy Hochul of New York addressing the room. There's a photograph of David C. Banks, the chancellor of New York City Public Schools. Server circulated among guests with yellowfin tuna spring rolls, caviar toast, and blood orange margaritas, offering them to a room that skewed heavily toward men in suits and ties as a pulsing ABBA track played in the background. The crowd included a mix of politicians, businessmen, and celebrities. Tickets started at $3,000, and tables ranged from $35,000 to $250,000. In the room were Governor Wes Moore of Maryland, Mike Bezos, Mark Bezos, Alexis Ohanian Sr., the NBA great Walt Clyde Frazier, and David C. Banks, the Chancellor of New York City Public Schools. Lorne Michaels, the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, was also in attendance and was credited with helping to secure the gala's comedian. There were performers on roller skates that wound their way through the room, helping to announce dinner. The night's co-chairs included Patrick Healy, the chief executive of Hellman & Friedman, Kristen Lemko, the chief executive of J.P. Morgan Wealth Management, and Henrik Lundqvist, the former New York Rangers goalkeeper. Around 7 p.m., the signal to dinner time, roller skaters in silver two-piece outfits conga'd through the party, which opened to reveal a giant dining room surrounded on all sides by screens. "This is like the Met Ball of Finance," said the artist Dustin Yellen, who founded the art center Pioneer Works. "I'm just like a lost poet. And so all these fancy people in their fancy suits get me excited about building weird stuff, you know. Every director needs a producer, and so, like, this is a hall of producers." Tory Burch, the designer, who was at last week's Met Gala, said that the two events were not quite as so analogous. Just a very different experience, she said. Different people watching and fun people watching. Robinhood's benefit raised more than $68.5 million, far exceeding the $26 million raised by the Met Gala. Nearby, Governor Moore mingled with other guests as artichoke carpaccio, followed by campanelle with braised beef, were being served. The night featured an appearance from the ESPN star Stephen A. Smith, and about midway through the evening, the band Mumford & Sons performed a few songs, later followed by a short stand-up routine from the comedian Nate Bargatze. Governor Kathy Hochul strode to the stage in a crisp white dress and encouraged people to keep giving. "Stick with what you're doing," she said, "but keep spending this money the way you have and know that you're making a difference in the lives of others." Afterward, Richard R. Burry, Jr., the chief executive of Robinhood, joined Mr. Banks, the chancellor, to announce a new partnership with the Relay Graduate School of Education. The initiative funds leadership training for superintendents and principals based on research that shows a correlation between strong school leadership and student achievement. Paul Tudor Jones II, the billionaire hedge fund manager and co-founder of Robinhood, then appeared on stage dressed like Neo in The Matrix with a long black jacket, boots, and sunglasses. Clips from the film played in the background. "New York City faces a matrix of challenges," Mr. Jones cited, citing Robinhood's focus on education and calling on people to donate. Within minutes, $5 million was contributed, followed by several gifts of $1 million, all of which would go toward grants to help provide permanent housing, emergency food, and job training to people living in poverty, according to the organizers. As the speeches wound down, Post Malone prepared to take the stage. He performed for about 40 minutes as attendees packed the space, singing along quietly to the lyrics and bobbing their heads. Others filed outside into the crisp night and climbed into black cars waiting to drive them away. The next article is Tiny Love Stories from God You Can Kiss. This modern love column is in miniature, features reader-submitted stories of no more than 100 words. A Kiss to Remember. We kissed just once, standing by my living room windows on the 21st floor, a deep, full-throated kiss that shot electric waves through me. "God, you can kiss," I murmured. "Men who kiss men learn that." For a brief moment, we were in love. Then, his hands resting on my shoulders, he spoke, "You know, it can't work." He wasn't into women. "I know," I replied. "My friends thought we'd make a great couple." "We're just friends," I'd say. It was Texas, the 80s. AIDS took Richard a few years later, but his kiss is still with me. This article was written by Michelle Lanoux. Limeade Love. It was a contentious and unsuccessful expedition to shop for a prom dress, my mom being more focused on frugality than fashion. To restore peace, my dad, a caring parent, though with limited interest or capacity to relate to his teenage daughter, made the unprecedented offer to take me dress shopping. Round two. When we arrived at the mall, he confided that I could have any dress I wanted, a generous and loving gesture that made me feel both respected and liberated. "Thanks, Dad, for that memorable moment and dress. If only it weren't limeade green." This article was written by Judith Karp. A Sixth Sense. We met on the porch of the liberal arts equivalent of a frat house at the last party of the summer. She must have picked up on my introverted panic because she pulled an Adirondack chair next to mine and started asking me about the movies I'd seen. Never had I been so relieved to be rescued from the chaos of a crowd. Rosie, now my girlfriend, has always been good at noticing when I'm feeling untethered, and never has she failed to come to my side and let me know she's right there with me. This article is written by Emma Sandstrom. Grateful, my prayers went unanswered. He was utterly beautiful. Perfect skin, exquisite features, and the longest eyelashes I'd seen. But I was that rare Indian woman who hadn't wanted a son. I had prayed for a girl, for what did I know of little boys? My son did not know that. His giggles, his humor, the way he would grab and hug me, the way he would cling to me, every kiss and snuggle, made me forget that I hadn't wanted a boy. He walked into my heart one September morning and made it his own. I am the richer for it. The author is Arti Narayan. The next article is Unhitched. They were once hippie versus Soviet. Now they're the best of friends. We genuinely like each other, Alex Yaroslavsky said of his ex-wife and co-parent Liza Cooper. They even live in the same apartment building. This article is written by Louise Rafkin. In Unhitched, couples tell the stories of their relationships, from romance to vows to divorce to life afterward. Liza Cooper and Alex Yaroslavsky, both of New York City, met in their late 30s in March 2007 through a dating app. They married about a year later. Both secular Jews, the two seem compatible on paper, yet differences in their communication styles sometimes created conflict and ultimately brought an end to their marriage. But with patience, work, and a sympathetic landlord, the two managed to become dear friends and co-parents after their divorce. They now live on different floors of the same Upper West Side apartment building. Dates of marriage, June 15, 2008 to December 13, 2018. Age when married, Ms. Cooper was 37, Mr. Yaroslavsky was 38. They are now 53 and 54. Current occupations. She is an administrator in a hospital and a dating coach. He is an executive coach with his own company. Children, one son, age 14. Where did they grow up? In 1980, Mr. Yaroslavsky, an only child, immigrated to the United States with his parents when he was 10. The family had lived in Lviv, which was then part of the Soviet Union and is now Ukraine. He quickly learned English. Ms. Cooper was raised in Providence, Rhode Island, by New Yorkers who were devoted to each other and attentive to her. Her mother died before she met Mr. Yaroslavsky. Her father, who never remarried, now lives nearby. She has an older sister. How did they meet? In March 2007, they connected on a now-defunct dating app for Ivy League graduates. He went to Cornell and she Brown. He had been engaged before. She also had been in several serious relationships. Both felt some pressure to start a family. What was it about the other? Over coffee in a Union Square cafe, they bonded over their love for Costa Rica, where each had traveled. She found him smart, driven, funny, and cute. I had never met anyone with as many friends as Alex, she said. Great people from all over the globe. He found her pretty and sensual and appreciated her directness. Talking with Liza was fun and easy, he said. I could tell she would be a great mother. Why did they marry? One date led to another, but he was skittish about taking their relationship to another level. Within a few months, she pushed him to clarify his long-term plan. Once he committed, with no red flags yet having surfaced, they set a steady pace toward marriage. On New Year's Eve, 2007, he proposed, and they married 6 months later. She fell in love with his parents. He adored her father. Both families were very pleased. How were the early times? Both said they were good. They volunteered together at a dog shelter and enjoyed dining out. In February 2010, after their son was born, differences began to emerge. He was organized and neat. She was messier. Alex is in all hospital corners, she said. I'm more of a bohemian. He wanted to talk about budgeting and the future. She was more comfortable in the present. Sometimes what he thought were normal conversations erupted into fights. Were they happy? Some of the time. I was never taught to negotiate, she said. She was unhappy and disappointed a lot. He wanted to talk out problems, but she never wanted to revisit their issues or arguments. It's important to me and what I do in my work, and we just couldn't do it, he said. I didn't find it pleasurable to rehash everything with Alex, she said. I always just wanted to move on. First signs of trouble. They began to fight constantly, even at the dinner table. Hippie versus Soviet, she said, of their differing styles. We really polarized each other. Did they try to work on things? Starting when she was pregnant, they saw four therapists over 5 years. There were moments of understanding, but overall, their differences and their arguments prevailed. He wanted the two of them to have time together away from their son, and she didn't like leaving their son with others. He began to feel like a third wheel in the family. "We didn't develop the skills to stay together," he said. "Therapy showed me our friendship, our relationship was untenable," she said. "We often walked out of the sessions feeling worse." Who asked for the split? She did, in 2017. "It felt like throwing a hand grenade into the family structure," she said. But he said, "Liza was absolutely right to ask. I would never have asked or would have waited until our son was at college." The final breakup? They spent a year planning their split. On Valentine's Day of 2018, they moved into different apartments in the same building next door to where they were living. A sympathetic landlord, also divorced, adjusted their rents so each paid the same. Their divorce was finalized on December 13th that year. How did they move on? As they grew comfortable with being single again, each started dating. Occasionally, they ran into each other in the elevator while with their dates, which was comically awkward, but soon a friendship solidified. Now they share dating advice, and she recently helped him with his dating profile. "We still have some conflict, but nowhere near as much." Looking back, what advice would they offer others? Both said that working with a mediator made the split more civilized and helped the family heal. "Be kind, and don't hurt someone you married," she added. "I want to pick up my son to pick a good partner and be happy. We need to show our children that path."